Hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Adam Brody, an actor and producer who became a pop culture icon as part of the ensemble on the TV series The OC. He's parlayed that break into a decade and a half of interesting, unpredictable film and television work, most recently in movies like Life Partners, Sleeping with Other People, Isabel, and Ready or Not, where he co-starred with friends of the show Christian Brune and Mark O'Brien. You'll be seeing him soon opposite Carey Mulligan in Promising Young Woman, and he's currently starring in Evan Morgan's The Kid Detective, playing a former child sleuth still chasing his past glory. It's a very odd movie, and he's terrific in it, and you should check it out when you can. Adam picked Coraline, Henry Selick's 2009 adaptation of Neil Gaiman's fairy tale horror novel about a girl who escapes her humdrum home life by visiting a mirror world where everything is brighter and more welcoming, with all the food she can eat and all the attention she can handle, thanks to the distressingly cheerful other mother, who wants nothing more than for Coraline to stay with her forever and ever and ever. With Selick's stunning stop-motion vistas given life by the voice of Dakota Fanning, Terry Hatcher, Jennifer Saunders, Don French, Ian McShane, Keith David, friend of the show John Hodgman, Coraline creates an environment in which you could happily lose yourself. But maybe you shouldn't. This is someone else's movie.
I'm a relatively new father. My daughter is five now. And, you know, I have certainly seen as many kid movies in the last 5 years as I have adult ones. And the kid ones I see multiple times is the thing. So the ones I'm really studying are the children's movies. And I hadn't seen Coraline before that. And furthermore, it's kind of a genre, like female-centered stories as well is new to me, kid ones anyways. I grew up with most of the boy ones.
Sure.
And I'm loving this education. I mean, there's so many great movies that I'd never really seen. Sound of Music, Wizard of Oz, just like your classics. And certainly hadn't seen them and certainly hadn't studied them. And so watching all those has been really just wonderful. And Coraline is especially poetic and kind of meditative. And that's one of the things I love about it is if you're going to watch a movie 50 times, you kind of can't do better than this one, which has a very, it's slow paced and it's so reflective and symbolic and a little opaque. And the texture is so rich with that claymation and puppetry. I don't know if it's more puppetry or claymation or what, but it's so rich. It's so engaging to look at that I just find that endlessly fascinating. I just find the story so subtle's not the right word, but you know, for a kid's movie, like I said, it's very poetic and quiet. I've gotten into a lot of anime for the same reason. I don't want to inundate my child with, I mean, some people, including her school, would argue that like, don't show them anything, you know, screens are bad, but you know, I don't know. While she has been watching movies since she was very young. I mean, her second birthday party, when she was really too young to understand it, was a Coraline themed birthday party. But
more for the parents, I think.
It certainly was. Although, you know, she'd seen the movie a lot at that point. It was like too young to be scared by it, but then got a little older and was scared by it, and now has circled back and isn't scared by it anymore and loves it again. And what was I saying? I don't know.
You were talking about the conflict between screens and no screens and
But if you're gonna I just want to make sure that there's such a difference to me. Yes, there's screens in general, and then there's such a difference to me between just the idea of a screen, and then if you are they watching quality or not? And there's the little literal very tangible idea of like just how many edits and how in your face is it and how hyper. How hyper is it cut? And there's that element, which I think slower is obviously better for a young mind, or probably anyone for that matter. But also just the quality of, you know, because I'm so sensitive to that, the quality of themes and stories and characters and values that it is transmitting to your child, the unconscious ones that they're picking up. And it feels real. While I can obviously watch something terrible and be removed from it and kind of enjoy it and laugh at it and be it The Bachelor or whatever, it's way different feeding your kid mental junk.
Yeah.
And so I really try not to do that. I mean, you know, there's a few crappy things she likes that we've indulged her with for a little bit, but mostly not. Mostly, you know, she's like, she's got a pretty good film library, and I feel good about that. So anyways, things I love about it are just, you know, I'd be lying if I said I totally, like, we've looked up the symbology and the themes a bit, but they kind of have gone a little bit one in one ear out the other for me. But like a good song that the lyrics are a little opaque, I don't have to have the concrete answers or, you know, a good painting to exactly what everything means. I can deduce that there's a lot of, I can feel the power of it and the thoughtfulness behind it and the sensitivity. And yeah, that movie has a power. It's also, it's so dreamlike. It's incredibly quiet. You know, there's almost no background noise in it. There's the score, but other than that, it's just, you know, there's living in this house kind of in the middle of nowhere, it looks like. And so there's just, it's a very quiet movie, which is nice. And again, if you're going to watch something a lot, particularly with the child, it's nice for it to be quiet and peaceful. And even though it gets dark and, you know, those are some reasons.
Yeah. I saw it in 2009 when it played theatrically. I actually saw it. I think it was one of the only stop motion films I've seen in 3D.
I've seen it in 3D. That's interesting.
It works. It's, yeah, I mean, in addition to the way it plays with space and the spiderwebby stuff at the end, which is just, you know, gorgeous to look at.
Right. Right.
You really have a feeling of the tactile environment that this thing was handcrafted, was built. And yes. Yeah, it just made me appreciate the work that Henry Selick puts into the character design and his, I mean, this is the guy who made.
Yes. To me, it's my favorite visually of all this genre of stuff. It's kind of the high point to me where I don't really know what's going on behind the scenes, but it's even more the, did James and the Giant Peach, maybe after that, maybe before, Before. Even Nightmare Before Christmas, those are a little darker to me. And I don't mean tonally, I just mean literally visually, they're kind of darker. And it makes it a little less rich to me or a little, I don't know, I find it a little more depressing. It's weird, but like, there's something about Nightmare Before Christmas I really like, but I don't know. There's just like a bleakness to the background. I don't like as much. And then this, I think it's pronounced Leica or Leica, the studio Leica, that makes it. You know, I've seen Kubo and the Two Strings. We've seen that a bit. We've seen the Bigfoot one, Missing Link.
Yep.
And those, in addition to those scripts just being much less like mysterious and kind of, again, meditative, I guess. Those are a lot more, they're still subtle compared to your average, you know, animated movie, but sure, they're still more kind of straightforward, and loud. But, even the animation, even the visual stuff, and same with The Corpse Bride, Tim Burton, it feels like, without knowing this for a fact, even though I think they're using real puppets, it seems like computers are being integrated more and more and supplementing it, where I'm feeling less texture in them. And to me, Coraline is like the apex where it's like, feels like there's very little computer stuff, but it's a little brighter than, or Nightmare Before Christmas. And so visually, out of all these stop motions that I've seen from that studio and or the Tim Burton camp and Henry Selick, this is like visually hands down my favorite as well.
Yeah. I think the combination of Gaiman and Selick's perspectives is the real kicker for me. It's just, you know, you can pull back and look at it just as a piece of construction, and it is just a gorgeous film to watch. But it's got that thing that Neil Gaiman does where he pulls on the fairy tale aspects and just makes you really stop and think about what this story is offering. You know, it's a Hansel and Gretel kind of thing. There's a special place that children can go and maybe never leave because it's not nearly as nice as it seems to be. And just the whole thing, and it comes right out of the book, the buttons for eyes, and just how uh-huh. utterly unsettling that is. Uh-huh. And it just kind of slowly curdles around Coraline the same way it curdles in our minds, that she is, like, we know from the structure of every fairy tale that this isn't going to end well. But the way that Selick does that tonal shift with the camera, with it just getting a little closer to the characters, pushing in a little bit until we see what's wrong before Coraline does. And having, I mean, just casting Keith David as a talking cat who, you know, he's such a wonderful presence, but there are these little subtle suggestions that things are going to slide into a very bad place.
It's true. And as you said about the Neil Gaiman stuff, and I this is the only Neil Gaiman I'm really familiar with. At the same time, just knowing, like, you know, a little of his work. And I already said it, but it's just, you can feel the rich mythology that these other ones don't necessarily have. You can feel the rich mythology and the symbolism and the, you know, the hidden messages in it. And it just feels so rich in that. It's so kind of, that's why it kind of holds my fascination still, you know, I still, cause I quite literally haven't discovered everything in it yet. Yeah. As I said, I don't know. I'll probably never know. And that makes it endlessly fascinating.
Yeah.
In the way like a Donnie Darko does to me, you know, where it's like, I think I'm getting it, but I'm never going to really get it. And I don't really want to get it. But it always is always going to have that power over me because I can feel it from the filmmaker and I can see the clues. And it's so dense in that regard.
Yeah. I was going to say, there is the sense that, we're shown it literally that this has happened before, that this Coraline's not the first child to wander into this world, but there is this massive sense of history and texture going on beyond things. That's just so satisfying. I love seeing things on the, you know, like just the little details, things on the walls that we'll never understand, but they're just there. Because you would do that when you're building the world. And it's the enthusiasm for the creation of the world that then you have, again, that like this, I'm actually kind of annoyed that I had John Hodgman on the podcast once and we never got to talking about Coraline because that performance and the fact that they match him with his singing voice is John Linnell from They Might Be Giants.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. The Other Father song is it's a great, like it just, it's a perfect slide because the two know each other and they've worked together for years, it just works so well together. And it also, because like in 2009, John Hodgman was not the, like the popular presence that he is now. It was just such a weird little choice. And this nice little idiosyncratic move for this little animation studio in Portland to just not go with the standards, right? Just pick interesting
people. And honestly,
people.
Even Terry Hatcher is interesting. You know, I know that Desperate Housewives was probably on still then, but
I think so.
And I think she was in it, but still, you know, still this is a little arty movie, you know? So to take someone off of ABC and bring them there also is an interesting move.
Yeah. And to actually cast a young, like Dakota Fanning was still a kid when she did this rather than an adult voicing a child.
Yeah.
Just all the choices are, and I guess I'd never really considered it as a movie. The same with Paranorman. They're not, the Like is not really making these movies for kids. They're making it for, them for like us, for adults who remember what it was like to be kids and to have that intensity.
Yeah. Yeah. And, no, I mean, they're intense. It definitely flirts with being too scary. It's of the scarier variety for a kid, but at the same time, if you condition them right, they can handle it. At least my kid can. It definitely, obviously there's a lot for adults or I wouldn't be talking about it.
Yeah.
And
it's always weird to be talking about animated films on a podcast where people just can't see them. Like we can't pull up references, but I think this one's so vividly done that, you can conjure it in your head and the mood is what comes up, not the imagery for me. I just like, I feel the sort of weird autumnal tension in the film and the construction of the world and the way that everything is forbidding, but not foreboding. It's just, it's supposed to be appealing enough. Like, that's why I keep thinking about Hansel and Gretel, right? Because you're seeing a world where children are supposed to be enticed and preys on the innocent.
Yeah. And it is. And it is. You know, you're unlocking a mystery, and at the end of that tunnel is a golden world of delight that is corrosive and ultimately nefarious. And I mean, obviously the tale, wondering after watching all these kids movies and watching these female ones, and it's like, it's funny, but the girl in most of these is, I'm trying to think of, like, I can't from one, the boy centric ones from my childhood, because the girl, they're always orphaned. I mean, Coraline's not exactly orphaned, but she is, you know, they're cast out in the world. They're all Allison, not all, but I mean, there's so much of them. We've gotten really into, I mean, other movies I could talk about are Secret Garden and Little Princess.
Right.
Those, but you know, my daughter's always playing being an orphan, you know, maybe, maybe that says something about us as parents. I don't know. But yeah, the girl is cast out into the world without parents and kind of, you know, but I wouldn't necessarily say, but still somewhat of a victim in a lot of these, you know, I don't necessarily, some heroines are stronger than others. I think in the Secret Garden, she becomes a strong heroine. But not necessarily Alice in Wonderland, not necessarily Wizard of Oz, not, you know, I mean, maybe Wizard of Oz, but.
Well, these are stories like Snow White, even, or the Little Mermaid. Things happen to the characters,
exactly.
Right? Instead of them.
Exactly. And they're a victim, and they're orphaned, and they got to make their way in the world and can't trust people. And everyone's kind of, most people are using them for bad purposes, and, you know, they survive mostly. Mm-hmm. And then boys, I guess, are given much more agency. I mean, I'm trying to think of the famous ones. I don't really recall what happens in, I guess I kind of recall what happens in Sword of the Stone, but it feels like those are more even if I just think about, I guess, you know, barring more adult fare like Lord of the Flies, but like, you know, even my childhood of like Goonies or Explorers or
right.
E.T., you know, it's like you're granted otherworldly powers and you become a superhero, you know, you sort of. And
I mean, even in Back to the Future, which is the other big one from that era, the hero is somebody who has knowledge that no one else has, right?
Like, yes,
all chosen ones.
That's exactly right. And so it seems like these male-centered ones, yeah, you get a power. Mm-hmm. And then you get to, you know, a power that's bigger than you, and then you get to use that. And it's that wish fulfillment in that way. And obviously those characters are given more agency. And while on one hand I think about it and that seems, you know, problematic, at the same time, I've really enjoyed these more, the ones that are centered on girls, because they're just so much less violent. They're so much more thoughtful.
That's,
you know,
true.
I think about all these movies I want to show her, and every one of them, I'm like, ugh, I don't know. You know, they're so much more crass. And just, again, just like violent at their core. And, so that is one color that I'm not missing from showing her at this, you know, and it's just been interesting. It's been an interesting kind of to relive my childhood, but then through her eyes and the stuff she's taking in.
Yeah. Sorry, you don't mean...
I don't mean to say that none of these girl protagonists have a bunch of agency, but it is a trend I'm noticing where, you know, again, the orphans... they're orphaned. And then when I think about it, these boys get a lot of power, and clearly there's something to that. But even so, even despite that, like I said, I'm enjoying these stories, because they're just, if nothing else, less violent.
Yeah. And I mean, Coraline does also have a, like, the monster is a female character. It really is, like, men are very, very secondary in the story.
Very true. Very true. And she's pretty empowered, actually. Even though she is somewhat orphaned, she's a seeker. It's, you know, she seeks it out. She's an explorer, and she bravely and gamely fights to save her parents. So she's not, even though someone's messing with her, she's actually up to the challenge pretty early on. That's a actually particularly empowered character for this genre when I think about it.
Yeah. Well, and her sidekick, who doesn't exist in the book, the boy Wybie, who was invented, apparently, according to Wikipedia, so she wouldn't be walking around talking to herself for most of the movie.
Oh, interesting. I don't know.
But that also explains why he doesn't do very much. Like, right. He's right. There. Also, this time, the last time I watched it, he reminds me very much of Heath Ledger's Joker in a very strange way. Like, it doesn't...
Well, he's got those because he's stitched, you know, they stitch his mouth at one point closed.
Yeah.
So he's got the, you know, he's got that, like, it's scar, like smile.
Putting a hat on a hat by the time they do it. But he's also got that physicality. He shifts his shoulders in a really strange way has this awkward way of tilting his head down. I remember thinking it the first time that it kind of, I couldn't put my finger on it. And then this time it's just like, oh, that. But like, it's just a coincidence. The time it takes to make a stop motion film, there's no way they could have seen it.
Yeah, no. But, you know, the other thing about this movie is it's creepy. Everyone's kind of creepy. The parents are creepy, even in their good, even when they're being their best. The apartments, you know, the neighbors are creepy. The only one, even though you talked about Keith David as, you know, because it's his voice being somewhat menacing, he's kind of the only one, in my opinion, that's like very, if not warm, at least trustworthy. Hmm. Instantly, you know, he seems good, and everyone else, Wybie included, harder to trust. And yeah, Wybie's—he's introduced in a scary way. Even though when he's a victim later of the other mother, it's creepy looking. You know, the buttons for eyes are just such a terrifying, dehumanizing prospect. Anyways, but I mean, they're all creepy. Maybe no one more so than the dad, the other dad. I mean, he's kind of the most, even though it seems like he means well enough when he's powering down in the end and he's, you know, mother made me do it. Like that's,
yeah, it's the affable helplessness, but that also tells you that he's not going to help you when it comes down to it. The sense
I find there's something I find even more than the mom, who is her real mom, who is pretty, you know, not the greatest. I hate the dad. I mean, the dad is just despicable, in my opinion. And I know that the parents are somewhat redeemed in the end. But I guess what I like about it is, but they're also kind of not. I mean, they're also pretty worthless. Just to even start off with, especially that dad. I mean, just because it's not only like, I mean, number one, he's not there for his daughter. I mean, that's he's just not there. No one wants her. No one wants to be bothered, and he's not there. But also, he's just like the opposite of charming. I mean, he's just repulsive. He's repulsive looking. He sounds like a jerk. You know, like a just he's a repulsive cook. Just none of it you want to spend time with, except you do because it's so interesting. He's an interesting character and he's interesting looking, and it's fascinating in that way, but it's somewhat repellent.
Yeah. Neither parent is giving Coraline anything that she needs. And maybe that's where the orphan thing comes from, right? The resonance is that she's figuring out who she is on her own because she doesn't have the role models.
She's figuratively orphaned and then is orphaned when the mother takes them later.
Right.
But even before that, she's very much on her. She's very much a girl without a country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just, again, it's the kind of thing that you hear as a bedtime story, right? The fabric of it where things happen and they're inexplicable and then they're gone the next day. Everything's like the film ends with a return to normalcy, but the cat's still wandering around. We know this is real. Like Coraline will carry this forward with her forever, and hopefully not as trauma, but as like the foundation of her personality.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's such a wonderful, you know, style wise, she's got an iconic look, and you know, most cartoons are pretty vivid and, or animated anything or vivid, you know, you're going to have vivid characters and a lot of thought. So many hours are going to be spent making them. There's going to be a lot of thought into what they look like and wearing, but still she's got such a great iconic kind of punk look. That's also, I just really respond to.
Yeah, I had not read the book before seeing the film, and I was shocked to see that that design is original to the movie, that the book jacket is just kind of a more Alice in Wonderland look,
a more
normal kid.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen it. I haven't read the book. I've tried to get my daughter. I can't sell her on it yet, but I've tried to read it to her a few times. So I'm familiar with those pictures much more straightforward, but I love the attitude she's given in the, and what little details do I like? There's, she's going to the clothing store to try and get some gloves. You know, she wants these gloves, colorful gloves. And like two kids are running by going, one of them, I think it's Richard III, like my kingdom for a horse, just a random Shakespeare line as they're running by. A world this meticulously built is going to have nothing but detail, but still there's some, I don't know why the image of, there's this sequence where she's going around the house counting everything, and this rug won't, there's a bump in the rug that she kind of can't get to flatten out. And then in the end, she finally jumps on it. Right. And it just, that, when I think of that movie, that one image, weirdly, that sequence very much, stays with me.
That's great. I love it when people cling to stuff that vivid, or when things cling to people that way, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I know that Gaiman was very happy with the way it turned out, and I haven't gotten to talk to Selleck since, which is a shame, because he's just, I'm sure he's doing interesting stuff, whatever he's doing. But we ended up, he came to town, I think, when The Nightmare Before, no, it was the other, it was when James and the Giant Peach came out on Laserdisc back in the day.
Wow.
Disney brought him to Toronto for a tour, and we ended up sitting, I think he'd done a lecture for Ryerson's animation department or something like that, and we ended up just chatting for an hour about all animation ever. And he's just, his reference points are wonderful, and he knows everything, but he and Brad Bird does the same thing. They really only do the thing they do. Uh-huh. So he has that massive, massive history and knows what will work and what won't work. But he's a Henry Selick project is still going to have, you know, tall, skinny characters with spindly legs and sharp edges and elbows and things. And it's just so strange to me that he and Gaiman aren't just doing all kinds of stuff together, because their sensibilities are so perfectly meshed.
Right. I mean, I assume, and then again, like I said, I'm not well-versed in Neil Gaiman, so I guess I can't say totally, even though just from this, you know, from like absorbing the hell out of this one, I'm a very big fan.
His stuff is very, very dense narratively, so I think it's a problem with the adaptations. And because he plays with so many familiar concepts, I suspect that's a little daunting, because you can say, well, Coraline's like Alice in Wonderland. Well, why should we bother? Right.
Right.
American Gods is the thing that's probably the most ambitious of his. And that's so big, it has to be a television show.
Right. Well, that shouldn't be a problem anymore. I mean, that's what everything wants to be now anyway.
Yeah. So. I think it's in its third season. And actually Ian McShane is in that, and also, of course, is the voice.
That's right. Yeah. He's got those great band-aids on his knees and stuff in this.
That's right.
His band-aids.
Just speaks to a life, right? There's all this stuff that we don't see.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of the most richly, like, detailed movies I can think of. And again, I think some of that obviously is, like, due to the physical, you know, the world being built so meticulously, but it's just so rich. Do you know who does the score?
The songs are by a French composer named Bruno Coulet, who I am not familiar with at all. Apparently he's done quite a few.
Yeah, I've got those in my head. The opening credits are just wonderful, with the doll being repurposed to be a Coraline doll.
Yeah.
I mean, that's as fun to look at as anything in the movie.
Yeah, that was really beautiful to see on the big screen in 3D too. You can feel the stitching, like you can
I'm sure. I mean, I wish I understood it more to talk about it. Unfortunately, it's just one of those movies I feel a little bit dumb, because I've seen it, you know, start to finish at least 20 times, and yet, you know, have never. It's got such a charisma and potency that you know, I can watch it endlessly and yet never felt the necessary need to dig in too hard to connect all the sort of thematic and symbolic dots.
No, I get that. Just, yeah, let it be the thing that it is.
And it's very impressionistic and yeah.
Yeah.
It has a strong power over me nonetheless.
Oh, that's good though. I mean, it's good that you can continue to revisit it too, and that it holds up.
Yeah. And that goes to maybe how I am as a consumer. I mean, so much of my music or like music I consume and is, you know, I've never bothered to like even read the lyrics, you know what I mean? And my wife's the opposite. My wife like is the first thing she's listening to is like the story and the lyrics. And I was like, oh, that was just another instrument to me, the voice. And I caught impressions of these different lyrics and I sort of formed a picture in my head, but it almost never occurred to me to like really dissect, you know.
That's interesting. I come at it the other way myself. I'm much more lyric driven.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is just why I love They Might Be Giants so much and why I was just so delighted to recognize that form of music in Coraline. Cause I had no idea. I mean, I knew who Hodgman was, so I was sort of happy to hear his voice. And then when it turns into Linnell, it's just like, oh, wait a minute. I love those guys.
It's so funny. It's pretty seamless. Cause I, never knew the difference. And we've sung that song a lot at my house and, never knew the difference.
Yeah. They both have a kind of a nasal timbre going on. It makes perfect sense that one would become the other.
So we say a lot of lines at the house. I do that dad a lot. I say my monkey slippers. I'm not going to do the impression, but it's pretty good. My monkey slippers are blue. I say a lot, and we always say your mother knows you like the back of her hand. Say that a lot, and that's it. And then my daughter also occasionally she got in a phase. Really wanted a mango milkshake and a chicken and like really wanted the dinner like it. So we tried our best.
How did it work? Did it work for her?
It was okay. The mango milkshake, you know, she's more interested in the idea than the refreshment, but, and in the beverage, but, yeah, it worked. It was an afternoon.
Good. I mean, anything killed to pass time. The time at this point, right?
I was going
to
say, I killed some time.
Well, I'm trying to figure out a way. Usually the closing question on the podcast is if there's anything from the film being discussed that you've used or absorbed into your own sort of creative package. I mean, you were talking about doing the father at home in life, but I can't.
Have I purposed it for, because I do that. I mean, so much of what I do is like literally a line reading from Jim Carrey that's in my head for, you know, 20 years, I will like repurpose for something consciously or unconsciously.
Right.
Coraline is a little different because it's animated. No, I don't know. I can't think of anything consciously. Again, I could walk through other lines that we say all the time at the house, but that are now I'm thinking of ones that aren't the dad.
Yeah.
Coraline and her friends in the picture, her friends from Michigan, I think she's from in this. But things I've taken into my work. I can't say there is. And I think again, some of that's probably due to the animated nature of it. Cause otherwise, even if I wasn't taking a line reading, you know, I'm sure I'd absorb at least some physicality or something. And not to say that you certainly can do that. I mean, I was reading a Nicolas Cage is like one of my favorites and, you know, he's talking about getting inspiration from like, I think it's Edward Munch's The Scream, you know, and like,
see
and
that,
just like
yeah.
paintings and stuff. And it's so great. And you definitely, you know, it doesn't have to be a flesh and blood actor doing a lot, you know, to be inspired to bring into your work as an actor. But yeah, consciously, I can't quite think of anything that I have.
Yeah. I was trying to stitch it together somehow with The Kid Detective and Ready or Not, because they're both kind of characters soaked in regret. For things that they like regrets that they don't either understand or can't channel. And Coraline doesn't really line up there, but that's just the trick that I do with every guest trying to figure out if I can bring them back to it myself.
Of course. I mean,
It just doesn't, does it?
No, I mean, I guess, you know, look, I mean, only this, and this isn't that I'm taking stuff from it. This just respond, but when you mention both those movies, it's sure. Like, certainly Ready or Not, but even The Kid Detective at a certain point has a dark humor and a fascination with the macabre, certainly more so Ready or Not. But again, Kid Detective has its violent moments and it's like darkly comic moments. Mm-hmm. It's never gothic. But so I do have, you know, I think, again, one of the reasons I'm certainly drawn to it is it's a dark, the dark tones. And so that's like a flavor that I'm always drawn to and while still having plenty of humor, you know?
Yeah. And it seems to suit you as an actor too. It's just the, I don't know exactly how to explain it, but there's an element of your established screen persona is someone who can handle glibly almost anything that's thrown at him. And seeing these films are the ones where I see you come up against a limitation of that, which I find really interesting. Just the idea that there are things you can't blow past, that there are things that your characters have to stop and struggle with. Does that make any kind of sense? It's just that's kind of how I see the energy that you're choosing to use these days without sounding incredibly pretentious about how.
No, it is. I mean, it's such a thoughtful discussion. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. That's
what I mean. Yeah. No, I can tell. As soon as we started, I was like, oh, I see. No, is my the glibness coming up against the real, you know, I wish I can see that in both of those, you know, I mean, I think it's a tone of humor and glibness and a gallows humor coming up against the reality of life and more so, I guess, the reality of death. And that's something I'm fascinated in. I'm fascinated by death. I think we all are, but I would say me more so than your average person.
Okay.
It's not something I even necessarily love about myself. It's just, I have been, I'm not really into serial killers or, you know, or even true crime. It's just more of like, it's more the existential question, but because of it, it causes me to, fixate on it, and I fixate on it with humor more than anything, you know, because that's kind of how I tend to the lens through which I tend to see most things. But as to the characters, I mean, certainly there was no master plan to you know, even find glib characters. These are just the best scripts that came my way. but they sought me out, you know, in that regard too. And it's, and so, you know, in some regard, they saw that in me. And, yeah, I mean, I think putting it maybe less thoughtfully, but it's like, yeah, I think I have a black humor, in real life. And certainly, now on screen more and more so. And while I don't think that Coraline is particularly bleak, I mean, I mean, there is a bleakness to it that I appreciate.
Oh, sure,
it's not, you know, it's not like a depressing movie, but like I say, I mean, the roses bloom in the end, but her parents suck. I mean, they've gotten a little better, but like, I don't believe that the movie is trying to convince us that like everything is, you know, no pun intended, rosy from here on out. And these parents are going to be wonderful people. I mean, I think they had a breakthrough. I think everyone had a breakthrough, but I think those parents, they're irredeemable in that every place is, you know, in that every person is flawed and, you know, nothing can be all good or all bad, but they're not redeemable to me in that, like, I don't know. They're never going to be charming parents. And I don't expect her to be super close to them when she grows up.
Yeah. That's the takeaway. You come away hoping that she figures it out, right? That her parents, like, she deserves better somehow.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't even, when I think about it in terms of her personal growth, I mean, I guess, like, what does she learn? I mean, I feel like she already kind of, she wants their attention like any kid does, but I don't even know necessarily that that's a lesson that she needs to, I don't feel like she's lonely. I think it's more just she's lonely than she's suffering from the constant crushing disappointment of her parents not, you know what I mean? It hurts her deeply that it's, I'm sure it does hurt, but I don't think like, she seems pretty armored up for it and pretty tough. And is already like a rebel a little bit. And so I don't feel like, you know, I feel like more than anything, it's she's lonely. And by the end, she's made friends. She's made a cat friend. She's made Wybie as a friend. You know, he seems like he'll be a good friend for the rest of it, even though he's introduced to us as creepy and has his creepy elements. He seems redeemable and like, you know, an innocent, a true innocent at the end of the day. And they'll be friends. YB's grandma as well. She's made her and everyone. She's seen everyone in their best light. There's the neighbor upstairs. There's the neighbors downstairs. There's the her parents. Everyone is in a better mood, and everyone's kind of become friends. And the roses are blooming. So, you know, she's brought out the light in all these characters. And again, I think if anything else, just the pure the idea that she'll be a little less lonely from this, but. I don't know that she's, I don't know that the parents, in my opinion, are like, I wouldn't go so far with that little snippet in the end to say that they're fully redeemed, you know? And like I said, I still don't picture a world where she's close to her parents when they grow up.
Yeah.
And I, because I fucking hope she's not, because they suck, you know, like I think they're terrible. And I mean, I don't know. It's like, they're nicer in the end, but it's not like they got on their hands and knees and like, you know, had a come to Jesus moment and really seem to be like aware of, you know, they seem like kind of uncharming drips and, you know, and she's very much not. She's a vibrant, lively girl who's got tons of spunk and has an exciting life, is an adventurer who like, I hope for her escape more than I hope for her not to be lonely. And I like that they're paying a little more attention. I like that she's found some friends, but I don't hope for her. I don't get the impression that the parents changed so much that I hope for her that, you know, I hope for her to go to college somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I still have that feeling like you've got greener pastures as you know, beyond, and this is some adolescence that, you know, you've got to make the best of.
Oh yeah. I'm not worried about her at all. She defeated a monster. No. She'll be fine. Yeah.
Agreed. Agreed.
My thanks to Adam Brody, whose new movie, The Kid Detective, is in theaters across Canada right now. If you're confident you can see it safely, maybe do that. Thanks also to Ali LaMare Shedden. She knows what she did. You can find Adam on Twitter at HandleBrody, all one word, HandleBrody, and you can find Coraline on Blu-ray and DVD from Universal Studios Home Entertainment. It's also available on Apple TV and Google Play, and streaming on Netflix in Canada. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where I host a bunch of podcasts these days in addition to writing about film and TV. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. They're pretty good. Stay inside. Watch movies, wear a mask if you go out. I'll see you next time.